I'm Jim Falzerano, and welcome to a special year-end podcast on the Bush years.
I have faith in freedom's power to lift up all of God's children and lead this world to a future of peace.
He invaded a country either on false pretenses or by mistake or a mixture of the two. He's presided over the worst economic crash since the 1920s, 1930s.
This is not a shining city on a hill anymore. This is a bit of a kind of slum tenement that needs to be cleared away.
Somehow you were not a patriot if you opposed that cracking down that came after 9/11.
God bless you, and God bless America.
In this program, we'll hear from the Guardian journalists who covered the key political events that have marked and marred George Bush's presidency during the last 8 years. The Florida recount after the election in 2000, the September 11, 2001 attacks, the subsequent war on terror, Hurricane Katrina, and the near collapse of the U.S. economy. As we review these events and Bush's reaction to them, we will be asking whether, as most would have it, Bush is indeed the worst president in U.S. history. Or maybe, just maybe, we've all misunderestimated W's legacy. It's December 2008, and the final few weeks of the presidency of George W. Bush, the 43rd president of the United States of America. He leaves not so much with a whimper, but to a virtual chorus of boos from a nation who so emphatically voted for change in the form of his successor, Barack Obama, whose charisma, intellect, and oratorical skills contrast so greatly with Bush's own. Bush exits the White House with the longest sustained period of public disapproval ever recorded, and with some major problems waiting in the Obama in-tray. Military conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, a record-breaking national debt, and the biggest financial crisis to hit the American economy for a generation. On the larger scale, the reputation of the United States as the beacon of democracy, the mythical city on a hill, has perhaps never been more sullied. America is, without question, a superpower on the ropes. So where did it all go so wrong?
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
George Walker Bush came to power in 2001, following Bill Clinton's two terms in office. The son of a former president from one of America's most privileged political families, he ran as a compassionate conservative against the Democrat Al Gore in the November 2000 election. His victory was only assured after the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the razor-thin margin he achieved amid huge controversy in Florida. Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland.
One of the surprises to me about the very first period of the Bush presidency was that I, and I think others, assumed there would be a cloud hanging over it left over from the deadlock of the Florida decision, and there would be really a question of legitimacy hanging over him. And I and others thought also that this wouldn't just be Democrats hostile to him, but almost something he himself would feel. And lots of people wrote at the time that he'll feel restrained as if he hasn't got a real mandate. He'll have to be bipartisan, he'll have to be very limited in what he does, because he'll know he only got there by one vote of a justice on the Supreme Court. The reverse in the end happened. Not only did he clearly feel unrestrained, and that would become clearer and clearer as the months went on, but also Americans with this amazing talent for erasing the past and starting over just put that behind him and sort of forgave him the Florida decision, Democrats as well as Republicans, and just embraced him as their new president. And he had pretty decent approval ratings right at the beginning. And the notion that somehow he was the illegitimate president really did fade away.
Although Bush was put into power by just a single vote on the Supreme Court and without a majority of the popular vote, the Republican Party controlled both houses of Congress. Bush, therefore, set about governing as though he had won the election by a landslide. One of his first acts as president was to sign a $1.3 trillion tax cut, a cut that largely benefited the rich and big business. Furthermore, As a born-again Christian, Bush set about putting religion at the center of his neoconservative agenda for both domestic and foreign policy. The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Julian Borger, says there's no doubt that God had a seat in the Bush cabinet.
He told Bob Woodward that he didn't answer to his own father, who many thought would be a better role model in terms of running the country. He answered to a higher authority, which said a lot about the Bush internal dynamics of the Bush family, but also said a lot about where he got this sense of certainty, determination, and this lack of self-questioning and this lack of curiosity from. He believed that his acts were guided.
For the first 8 months of his presidency, Bush's approval ratings hovered around the 50% mark. But then, everything changed.
This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers.
Our way of life, the World Trade Center. Our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts. I've directed the full resources of our intelligence and law enforcement communities to find those responsible and to bring them to justice. We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them. None of us will ever forget this day. Yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world.
Julian Borger was reporting in Washington on September 11th.
After the second plane hit the World Trade Center in New York, it was obvious something was going on, very serious, sustained attack. And so we in Washington jumped in a car and headed towards National Airport, which would have been a disaster because if we got on the plane, we would have ended up diverted to Canada, where all the other planes going to New York went. But as it happened, as we were driving across the Potomac, a call came from London and saying, well, we heard a plane has gone into the Pentagon. And we said, well, no, I think we would know. Being on the Potomac itself, and the Pentagon is right on the south bank of the Potomac, we would know if a plane had hit it. But in fact, it had, and we began to see the smoke rise from the Pentagon. Our office manager dropped me there, and I ran round the side of the Pentagon, and there was Donald Rumsfeld in his shirt sleeves outside this huge gaping hole. And then suddenly, a whole section of the Pentagon collapsed. By late afternoon, I realized I'd have to file, but there was no way of getting back to the office other than walking. And I walked across the 14th Street Bridge, which is a bridge, quite a wide bridge, many-lane bridge. There was just a few other people walking, and no cars, smoke rising from the Pentagon, and constant rumors about when the next strike was going to come, and F-16s circling the air. It was a real post-apocalyptic scene. It was an extraordinary moment, and one that you'd never imagined would hit the capital of the United States.
In the immediate 24 hours after 9/11, George Bush's reputation was not good.
Jonathan Friedland.
There was the unforgettable image of him reading the children's story, My Pet Goat, to the class of kids in Florida and looking absolutely rattled, as perhaps anyone would. And then this 24-hour period where no one knew where he was, and he was flying from one undisclosed location to another, where people felt actually the brave thing to do would have been to straight away from the White House and reassure the nation. So his stock was quite low. It then went up when he actually went to the site of 9/11 and grabbed the megaphone, the bullhorn, and he said, "Can you hear me? I can hear you, and the world is soon going to hear from us." That kind of apparent show of strength really saw his approval ratings rocket. In a gesture of solidarity, America had been attacked, so everyone unites behind their president. So his approval ratings went very high in the 70s and 80s. And he used that to drive through a whole lot of really quite draconian legislation in the name of the war on terror.
These laws included the infamous Patriot Act, a piece of umbrella legislation giving federal authorities the power to snoop into all sorts of places they've never been allowed to look before. Operating both within and without the limits of this legislation, government agencies would check on citizens' library records, wiretap their telephone conversations, and scan their emails. Meanwhile, rules on the rights of non-American citizens grew tighter and tighter, most chillingly in the legal twilight zone of Guantanamo Bay. These erosions of civil liberties were the price to pay to ensure freedom, or so Bush would have had the country believe. And what about retribution for these attacks on American soil? Simon Tisdall is The Guardian's foreign affairs columnist. He says Bush missed a golden opportunity when he went looking for revenge.
Even the Iranians were ringing up and offering their help. There was enormous outpouring around the globe of sympathy and empathy for the United States at that point. Everybody wanted to pitch in to see what they could do. But Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and the others said, no, no, we're going to do this unilaterally. We'll do it by ourselves and we'll do it our way and we'll start by waging war in Afghanistan.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. We are joined in this operation by our staunch friend, Great Britain.
The American invasion of Afghanistan began in October 2001. It successfully toppled the Taliban regime that had provided support and shelter to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. But Bush's choice of rhetoric, as so often has been the case during his presidency, was unfortunate, to say the least. The commander-in-chief adopted the swagger of America's cowboy-in-chief. Julian Borger.
Well, he was asked in the White House about the search for bin Laden, and he said, yeah, like in the old Western poster, we'll get them dead or alive. That has haunted him throughout his presidency because he didn't get them dead or alive. Osama bin Laden or Zawahiri are still out there somewhere, and so is a hierarchy still out there in the Pakistan-Afghan border. And what he set out to do, what he told the American public he would do, he failed to do.
At least looking back, he sees the error of his ways.
I learned some lessons about expressing myself maybe in a little more sophisticated manner. Wanted dead or alive, that kind of talk. I think in certain parts of the world it was misinterpreted. So I learned from that.
In 2003... America's military strategy changed from hunting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan to toppling Saddam Hussein and capturing weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Everyone agrees there was one fundamental mistake. He went after the perpetrators of the 9/11 attack in Afghanistan. He knew where they were. And in the middle of it, he diverted all this attention, resources, manpower to Iraq. Specialists from U.S. Special Operations, translators, all these resources were taken away from the hunt for bin Laden and the al-Qaeda leadership and sent off to Iraq. It was fatal for the campaign in Afghanistan.
The United Nations refused to sanction the military action in Iraq, and millions of people took to the streets in over 600 cities across the world to protest the illegal war.
This is a war! What was imagined, planned, and organized from Washington and from London.
3 weeks into the invasion, Baghdad was taken by the U.S.-led coalition. On May 1, 2003, wearing an inappropriately tight flight suit, George Bush gave a televised address aboard an aircraft carrier declaring the mission in Iraq had been accomplished.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
5 years later, with the death toll mounting and no clear exit strategy, the U.S. is still no closer to finding bin Laden or Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. Simon Tisdall.
They used the pretext of 9/11 to launch an even more grandiose and even more disastrous adventure in Iraq. That still is scarring the United States to this day. I was in Arlington Cemetery a couple of months ago just before the election looking at some of the graves of people coming back from Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan and Operation Iraqi Freedom in Iraq. And one really is wondering now why those 4,000 or more American men and women have died, what the purpose of it was. How do you hold responsible the people who led the United States into that disastrous war? Disastrous not just militarily, but also diplomatically and economically in terms of U.S. regional influence, in terms of U.S. standing in the world. How do you call them to account? And still there has been no real thoroughgoing inquiry into the roots of the Iraq war, which I think under the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress one would hope to see.
With the 2004 election against John Kerry fast approaching, Bush's approval ratings had dropped to barely 40%. Yet in November, he was returned to the White House for a second term, albeit by the smallest ever margin for an incumbent president. But as the saying goes, nothing fails like failure. The war in Iraq was anything but over and felt more like the quagmire in Vietnam with every passing day. The controversy over the so-called dodgy dossier that the U.S. and Britain had used to justify the invasion fueled public dissent, and the Bush administration poured petrol on these flames by continuing to abuse civil liberties at home and abroad, most publicly in Guantanamo and the Iraqi prison camp at Abu Ghraib. It seemed things couldn't get any worse. But then came Hurricane Katrina.
And the frustration builds. Crisis in New Orleans and beyond.
For the Bush haters, we're in a frenzy in South Florida.
People need to send stuff in here. We are desperate.
We need help. We really need help.
In Baghdad, they airdrop water, food to people. Why can't they do that to their own people?
President Bush don't need to be the president no more. President Bush ain't doing his job.
I have never, ever seen anything as badly bungled and poorly handled.
They've been telling us buses coming. Don't go to the Superdome, come to the convention center.
Their government has failed them.
And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
I think the critical turning point in the Bush presidency turned out to be Hurricane Katrina.
Julian Borger.
Because until then, the majority of the American public were prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt in Iraq. It was a long way away. It was technical. There was lots of conflicting arguments about WMD. And so through 2004, which got him through the election, he was able to hold that majority together. With Katrina, that completely collapsed because I think people saw that if they were capable of such a calamity, a fiasco, a debacle in a major American city, who knows what they're doing in Iraq?
The full scale of the natural disaster unfolded live on television. And Bush, who had refused to cut short his holiday when the hurricane hit, seemed to watch passively as New Orleans went underwater. Thousands of people were left homeless, and huge areas of Louisiana were destroyed. Gary Young was reporting on Katrina for The Guardian.
It was like Haiti with skyscrapers. I mean, what it did was it washed up the world that America likes to forget it has, which is a developing world within the overdeveloped world. That was a stunning thing to see in such a dramatic setting. It was a stunning thing for the world to see, which is, you know, for the most part, the world imagines an America that we consume on TV and in film and music and so on. And this other America, this impoverished America, it's not that it's unknown to people, but it's regarded as marginal. And this, in some ways, I think that Katrina did more harm to America's standing around the world than Iraq did.
Fundamentally, for a president who had been preaching small government and who had for so long neglected the country's urban underclass, this was a privatized response to a public disaster.
The truth and the fact is, Cuba would have done it much better. It's a lot more common to have these hurricanes in Cuba and far less people die. But it was every person for themselves. Get in a car, in your own car, drive out of town, find a hotel for yourself. You need government, you know, to organize these things. There was this moment where Brown is asked by CNN, what about these 75,000, however many people who are outside the dome? And he said, we're seeing people that we never knew existed.
Jonathan Friedland agrees.
I'm tempted to call Hurricane Katrina the low watermark of the Bush presidency, but that obviously can sound tasteless. But it was that even those people who had stuck with Bush through the Iraq War, the decision and the handling of that, plenty of them just had enough with Hurricane Katrina. It was the incompetence, and it was the cronyism, the notion that this Michael Brown, whose previous job had been dealing with racehorses, was suddenly in charge of emergency management in the United States. And when a city was drowning, for George W. Bush to say to this Michael Brown, heck of a job, Brownie, as if he was blind to what everyone else could see, the slowness of the reaction, the lack of care, that which people immediately interpreted as being racially driven, that black people were drowning, so who cares, was seemed to be the message from the White House. I think that sank Bush's reputation. And you look at the poll numbers, they never recovered after that. He was in the doldrums with there or thereabouts the lowest poll numbers of any American president from Katrina onwards. So if 9/11 and the handling of that had boosted his reputation, if Iraq hadn't persuaded you that this was somebody who was not a fit and competent president, Katrina certainly did.
The impact of Katrina and the continuing quagmire in the Middle East left Bush a lame duck president. By 2007, the Democrats had regained control of the Senate and the House of Representatives. Karl Rove and Donald Rumsfeld, two of the masterminds of the Bush administration's neoconservative, hawkish agenda, had resigned. With oil prices continuing to rise sharply and the healthcare system in a mess, the nation prepared to go to the polls once again in 2008. Both candidates couldn't distance themselves enough from the outgoing president. The Republican John McCain declared himself a maverick who would end the pork barreling and culture of cronyism in Washington. Barack Obama said the country needed change, not four more years of the same. And then, after years of deregulation and carefree borrowing, the economy really tanked.
A short time ago, the House of Representatives passed a bill that is essential to helping America's economy weather the financial crisis. The Senate passed the same legislation on Wednesday night. When Congress sends me the final bill, I'm going to sign it into law.
And when the time came for America to decide who would become its next president, the choice wasn't that hard.
Hello, Chicago! It's been a long time coming. But tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
So, as we approach the end of this podcast, just how will history remember the 43rd President of the United States? David Motes is editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald in Rutland, Vermont.
It would be hard to exaggerate the extent to which this nation has been demoralized by the last 8 years, in the sense that, everything at this point seems to be going wrong. In the larger sense, I think President Bush took a conservative point of view, the politics of Ronald Reagan, and kind of drove it into a ditch. Cutting taxes is the be-all and end-all of economic policy. Now we've just seen debt mushrooming, the financial system falling apart, lack of faith in government, because basically Bush didn't believe in government, so he put cronies in who didn't believe in government, and it's been a new era of incompetence in government. And so a lot of people have seen a failure of leadership, and people realize they've been lied to. They've seen torture as government policy. It's demoralizing, and this is one reason why Barack Obama has excited such transcendent hope.
Perhaps it's fitting, therefore, that this oafish Texas aristocrat, who almost choked to death on a pretzel and had a shoe thrown at him during his official farewell to Iraq, is succeeded by his absolute antithesis, the urbane and sophisticated Barack Obama. But the worst president in history tag is just a little too convenient for The Guardian's Simon Tisdall.
One reason we all think Bush is terrible, many of us think Bush is terrible, is because we've experienced his presidency in real time. We didn't experience the presidency of, say, Richard Nixon, most of us, or Herbert Hoover, or Andrew Jackson, or any of the others going all the way back to the Founding Fathers in the same way. So we have a very different perspective on what Bush has and hasn't done. In polls that have been taken since 2000, he is regularly counted to be just about the worst among by American voters. But on the other hand, again, they didn't experience those other presidencies, so it's hard to compare. When you do polls among academics and historians, Bush is not necessarily the worst. And one of the reasons for this is because, defined terms, what does worst mean? Was he, for instance, the worst in terms of national security and his role as commander-in-chief? Well, you would say that a president who fails to protect the United States against a massive and murderous assault, fails to see it coming and fails to stop it, must be just about the worst in terms of commander-in-chief. And of course, Bush was guilty in that regard. He didn't see the 9/11 attacks coming, despite intelligence that was available to him, and he certainly failed to stop them. Thousands of Americans died. But another president also made a similar slip-up in 1941, and that was Franklin Roosevelt, who was widely, by other criteria, thought to be one of the best American presidents. Again, in terms of economics, we're now looking at perhaps the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. That's happened on Bush's watch. Does that make him the worst? Well, students of Herbert Hoover might argue, because not only did Hoover preside over that, but he failed to stop what was a recession turning into a long-term depression, which in the end helped trigger the Second World War. And then again, you know, if you look at the presidency as the president, as a man who upholds the values, standards, and beliefs of the nation, as a role model of moral authority, then actually it's hard to fault Bush in terms of his personal conduct. His immediate predecessor, one only has to say Monica Lewinsky, and you see where this argument's going, would appear to have behaved much worse.
Jonathan Friedland agrees that Bush-baiting Clinton acolytes should probably reassess their myopia, if only slightly.
It will be interesting to see what exactly historians choose to dump on Bush for. I mean, there's such a range of things they could choose. Some will be very drawn to saying that the final nail in the coffin of his reputation was the economic collapse that happened on his watch. And for that reason, he will be compared to Herbert Hoover, for example, whose name is always inseparable from the Great Depression. My guess is that actually some historians will want to be fairer than that and say, actually, the blame predates Bush. Certainly Bush did nothing to make it better, the economy, but the carnival of deregulation slashing through red tape actually began in the Clinton years, and it was Robert Rubin as Treasury Secretary and his disciples who really were letting the banks rip, and what we saw in 2008 was the consequences of that. And so in that sense alone, very narrowly, you might say it's unfair to blame it all on Bush. Nevertheless, reputations are often not made that subtly, and people will just say, on top of the calamity of the Iraq War, which many people believe the greatest foreign policy error in 50 or 60 years, greater even perhaps than Vietnam, on top of that, you have the calamity of Hurricane Katrina, and then on top of that, a recession on a par with the Great Depression. I mean, it's not much of a record, and people, I don't think, will be very, and historians, and the future, I don't think, will be too sympathetic to Bush.
We'll leave the final word to Suzanne Goldenberg, The Guardian's Washington correspondent who's followed every step of Obama's triumphant campaign as Bush has floundered in the home stretch.
I think the most striking thing for me now is the sheer irrelevance of George Bush, or the seeming irrelevance of George Bush, because he is indeed president until January 20th. But he seems such a forlorn figure now. And if you think back to the post 9/11 atmosphere. I mean, this is a man who went to war on Afghanistan, who went to war on Iraq, who seemed unstoppable. You know, the Democrats could not come up with an adequate political challenge to him. He sort of took on the opprobrium, the world community, and, you know, came out on top. So there is such a contrast now when you see, towards the end of those 8 years, this sort of bedraggled, wistful figure leaving the White House, and the person who had such an effect on this planet, I mean, in the world at large, and certainly in the U.S. at home.
You've been listening to The Bush Years. It was written and produced by Ben Green and presented by me, Jim Falzerano. For the very best news and analysis on George Bush's legacy and the Obama White House, head to guardian.co.uk/America.
Thank you for listening. May God bless you.